And we're live.
Yes.
And we're good. And we're great. We're great. We're awake. We're ready to conquer the day. You just opened your mouth to yawn so wide you could have swallowed the planet. Is college life getting to you?
I think just general existence in this time of peril is getting to me.
But I mean, are you staying up too late because of school?
That wasn't just a college thing. That was an insomnia thing.
Oh, I see. Or do you have a lot of homework? Do you have a lot of like work to do?
Not really.
Outside of class? Besides writing. I know you have to write.
I think that takes more than like 2 minutes.
Except for writing short stories. A story should not take any longer to write than it takes to read. That's a good rule of thumb.
That's a terrible rule of thumb.
This week's short story, it wasn't very short.
No.
At all. It was actually a long story.
Long boy.
It was a pretty long boy. In more ways than one, it had a couple of long boys as characters.
Yeah.
This one's considerably longer than the other stories in the book so far. Well, I don't know. Call of Cthulhu, we split over 3 episodes.
It was split into 3 parts.
Yeah. Well, this one's divided into 9 chapters.
Yeah, but that's unimportant.
Yeah, this story spends a lot of time being a story. Like, I don't fault it for its length. It makes sense the way he's writing it, but it is, for what happens in it, it sure is long.
Mm-hmm.
But it does go some places. It goes places. Should we just go ahead and introduce this episode?
Yeah.
Yes. All right. I am Phil.
And I'm Willow.
And it's Del Toro,
Del Toro time.
It's Del Toro time. It's Del Toro time.
"30 years ago, an elderly man, to whom I paid quarterly a small annuity charged on some property of mine, came on the quarter day to receive it. He was a dry, sad, quiet man who had known better days, and had always maintained an unexceptionable character. No better authority could be imagined for a ghost story."
You just heard me reading the opening of J. Sheridan Le Fanu's Mr. Justice Harbottle. Not Hardbottle, as I said last week. There's no hard bottles in this one. Just one soft bottle.
Stop.
Does Mr. Justice sound... Okay, just to clear things up, because I know there was some confusion in our Hawthorne episode. We all know that Justice is not his first name. Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This isn't going to be a deacon situation.
Deacon situation. I didn't know deacon was a word.
Okay. Well, you do know that justice is a word because there is none in this world anymore.
Yep.
So, So Mr. Justice sounds redundant. I know that's like how you would refer to him back in like the, 1700s when this is set, but it's still like if I was called to court, I wouldn't say Mr. Your Honor. I would just say Your Honor or Ms. Mm-hmm. Your Honor or Ms. Judge. So what do you know about Sheridan Le Fanu?
Nothing.
I just, one day I'm going to ask that question and you're going to be like, well, and you're going to like just pull out a laundry list of facts you already know about the author.
One day you're going to ask that question and it's going to be about someone I know.
Mm-hmm. But Sheridan Le Fanu is
See,
not.
The thing is, I don't care enough about these people to do any research.
Why don't you care about them? They're useful men. Why don't you care about these writers? You're a writer. What if they didn't care about you?
They don't.
I know. They're long dead. They're gray bones in a grave. J. Sheridan Le Fanu, Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu, was an Irish writer. Details on his life are a little scanty just because he wasn't very successful in his life, even though he wrote a ton. He didn't become like kind of well-known until M.R. James really started pumping up the fandom about him, but he is considered basically the grandfather of modern or like gothic British horror in the late 1800s. Like he created the ghost story as we know it. He also has been credited with creating the English short story as we know it. Before him, short stories, I don't know how to say it. They just weren't this. They weren't what we think of as short stories. They were different. So he's one of the founders of the form of the short story in English. But just a little background on J. Sheds here. He was born to a Dublin Huguenot family. His family moved around a lot when he was a kid. He was privately educated, just sort of taught himself how to be smart. He was born in 1814, just so we have a little mm-hmm. Timeline here. Yeah, he went to Trinity College in Dublin, and he got his law degree in 1839. But like so many of these writers who we have studied, he was like, I'm not gonna be a lawyer, I'm gonna be a journalist. And that sort of got him into writing. However, knowledge of the law really comes into play in a lot of his stories, and in particular, the horrific justice system at play in the UK and in Ireland and in England and all these places at the time. Like just how there was no justice in the justice system. It was run by horribly corrupt judges, horribly corrupt barristers, and you didn't stand a chance if you found yourself in the justice system. Also, at the time, especially, forgery was such a capital crime that there were so many people being hung for forgery. That was like a big deal. Because the worst thing you could do was commit a crime against money, was commit a crime against capitalism. And that was kind of where Jay Sheridan, a lot of Gothic writing from this time can be seen as a critique of this system, the modern capitalist system. There's a lot of decay of old money involved in these.
It's funny because we live in capitalist society as well.
We do.
And all the people in charge commit money fraud all the time.
Right. And I think what they try to say is people would get executed for forgery a lot. Maybe not the people who necessarily should have been committed for their crime. So he became a writer. He was a contributor to Dublin University Magazine. He took over the Protestant newspaper, The Warder. And so for a while, he was just a journalist. In 1843, he married Susanna Bennett, who was the daughter of a barrister, and they had four kids. And they were poor. And when she died at the age of 34, he blamed himself. He blamed himself for not being able to give her the proper life. He retreated from public life at that point and became known as he became known as the Invisible Prince, because this is when his writing output really kicked off, but no one ever saw him. He was just this mysterious like figure, but it's because he was just massively depressed over the death of his wife, just mourned for the rest of his life about her. When he was a student, he created a character named Father Francis Purcell, which was later published in a collection called the Purcell Papers. Between 1845 and 1873, he published 14 novels. Uncle Silas was one of the big ones in 1864. The House by the Churchyard, 1863, is another huge one. And then he published a short story collection called In a Glass Darkly, which this story appeared in. It contained the stories Green Tea, The Familiar, Mr. Justice Harbottle, and The Room in the Dragon Volant, and Carmilla. And they all concern they're all supposed to be stories from the files of Dr. Martin Hesselius, who is considered the first occult detective, even though he only appears in one story and none of the other stories have anything to do with him. He just needed a way to tie all these stories together. So he created this character, Martin Hesselius, but who went on to inspire all the occult detectives in fiction. Like he was kind of the big thing that kicked that off. This story, Mr. Justice Harbottle, is purportedly a rewrite of a story called An Account of Some Strange Disturbances in Anger Street, which I covered in a bonus episode earlier this week, just so that we had something to put out on Thursday, a 10-minute bonus episode. The only similarities between the two stories, there's a judge, hangs himself, there's ghosts. That's it. Everything else is completely different. So
ghosts.
We're not... What?
Ghosts.
Did you belch the word ghosts?
No.
Oh
my
God. I
said it really quietly.
It sounded like you belched it in my ears. You went, ghosts? I wish you'd belched it. And that brings us to the story, Mr. Justice Harbottle, which was originally published in Belgravia, a London literary magazine, in 1872 as The Haunted House in Westminster. But then it was revised and retitled Mr. Justice Harbottle in A Glass Darkly that same year. So that's Jay Sheridan Le Fanu. That's the origin kind of this story. Willow, what is this story even about?
A bad, bad man.
I'm a bad, bad man. And it is, I'm going to assume from your saying that this story is all about the redemption of this bad, bad man, a la Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol.
Definitely.
How he becomes a good, good man and helps a small boy lose his crutches.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the end of the episode, everybody. Goodbye.
Obviously, it's a lie. What is Mr. Justice Harbottle actually about?
This corrupt judge who's presiding over this trial of this man, mm-hmm. whose wife he wants to sleep with?
Is his housekeeper?
Yeah.
Yes.
But he wants her to be his mistress.
Or she already is his mistress.
Yeah.
It's vague.
And he gets this, is it a letter or a vision? I can't remember.
Is it a letter or a vision? The book is very vague about that too. He's visited by an old man. Originally.
Yeah.
The first thing that happens, he's visited by a very old man, a rickety old man.
Who's like, hey, if you don't judge this fairly, we're going to judge you.
Yeah. Who's we?
The what is it called? I have it up on my phone. I can't have the book near me or I start flipping.
You start flipping, especially at this in this state.
Yep.
The High Court of Appeal.
Yeah. I don't think it's ghosts. That's just what I'm going to say.
Well, this is where things get weird, because what happens with this mysterious old man?
I spent too much time thinking about fairies when we were reading this.
The mysterious old man, Lee, he's like, you can't try this case. There's this guy who's been arrested for forgery. His name is Pineweck, Lewis Pineweck. He's like, we've decided you're not allowed to try this man. There's conflict of interest here. We'll be watching you. And he leaves. Justice Harbottle sends his footman after him to see where this guy lives. When his footman gets too close, the old man's like, oh, I dropped a coin. Can you help me pick it up? And when he goes to pick it up, the old man suddenly reveals himself to be a young man, clobbers him, and then runs off. So we have, like, he wasn't even an old man to begin with. And then Justice Harbottle is like, that old man actually looked like this guy, Lewis Pineweck, in disguise. Like, it looked like him. Like, it looked just like him. And that's where things start getting weird.
Mm-hmm.
The reason it's getting weird is this whole story is about duality. Like, dual, like, identities, dual narratives, dual... it's all about doppelgangers and lookalikes and...
I don't think it's ghosts.
Well, so, he tries the case anyway. Because this guy, Lewis Pineweck, his housekeeper is Lewis Pinewick's wife, who stepped out on him or left him or something, and her daughter lives there too.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of the commentaries I was reading said that there's some evidence that Justice Harbottle is actually the child's father, although I couldn't find any evidence of that. Like, I have no idea what that's talking about, but
there's no evidence for anything ever.
In any case, what? That doesn't make any sense.
I mean, a lot of interpretation from stories takes a lot of things out of context. That's just how stories work.
Right. This story is very weird and vague. Also, none of what we're saying is told in chronological order. Like,
yeah,
there's the prologue is just an accounting of the transcript of this story and where it came from, because this is Dr. Hesalius's notes. So it's his secretary telling us what we're about to read. But then the story itself is an accounting by a different guy.
It's another nested narrative.
It's super nested because it's this guy Harmon who is telling the story, but he gets told by an old man who he owes money to that the old man is moving because he lives in this house where he's been seeing these ghosts. So Harmon's like, I know this house. I have a friend who knows about this house. So he goes to his friend and gets a narrative from him about the history of the house. It keeps getting like, it's so like, it's the first, I'd say, quarter of the story is very difficult to follow because it's hard to track who is talking at what, like, wait, whose narrative is this? And I think that's intentional because the whole thing is supposed to read like you are reading a deposition in court. Like you are reading you're reading evidence, like put it forward. Here's different narratives. Here's where we found them. This just take this for what you will. It's very technical, but it makes the ending work for me. In any case, so Mr. Justice Harbottle tries the case in any case, finds the guy guilty and hangs him. But we know he's only finding him guilty because I think because he wants this guy out of the way. Like,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. But this guy may be guilty in any case. It says something about him being a domestic violence. Like, his wife left him, I think, because he was violent at home. Like, He's not a good guy. I don't think he's a good guy.
I think the problem isn't whether or not he's guilty. I think the problem is the reason he was found guilty is because this other guy has an ulterior motive.
Right. That's very clearly bad. It's a bad thing to do.
Yeah. I think that had he found him guilty for genuinely legal reasons, we would have had no problem.
Probably. Harbottle always has people over at his place. He lives in this giant house, and it's heavily implied that he's basically like having orgies all the time. Mm-hmm. Like just orgies. He's also a disgusting, gross old man.
Yep.
I think it says, I have a description of him right here. It says, he was a man of some 67 years. He had a great mulberry-colored face, a big carbuncled nose, fierce eyes, and a grim and brutal mouth. He had the reputation of being the wickedest man in England. In spite of council authorities and even of juries, he would carry cases by a sort of cajolery, violence, and bamboozling that somehow confused and overpowered resistance. He had never committed himself. He was too cunning to do that. He was a dangerous and unscrupulous judge, but his character did not trouble him. So not a good guy.
Yeah.
Not a good guy. Probably deserves to be tormented unto death. But who doesn't these days?
A lot of people.
A lot of people probably don't. So he tries him anyway, finds him guilty. The guy is hung. His wife, the housekeeper, isn't too happy when she finds out that her husband was killed. But we don't really get a whole lot of her opinion in this story. So later on in Harbottle's courtroom, he thinks he sees Pinewick among the crowd of people watching the case, and he pulls down his collar. And you see like the marks of a rope, and Harbottle's like, "Get him!" And everyone's like, "Who?" Which is more evidence to your theory that
it's not ghosts.
It's not ghosts.
But I don't think it's nothing.
Well, it can't be nothing because his footman got clobbered. Like,
yeah,
people see something. Like, there's something there.
I think it's fairies.
Well, let's wait till we get to the end and we can talk about that because I'm interested in your theory. So you have a feeling that he's starting to lose it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
He gets a letter that says the High Court of Appeal is going to put him on trial for murder. He's on the night of the 10th, he gets through a series of like, he falls asleep in a carriage. It's this long sequence. He falls asleep. He thinks there's these two guys in the carriage with him who are his friends. But when he wakes up, it's actually these like strange men who seize him and drag him off to a trial where he is tried by a jury of shadow people with glowing eyes. And the judge is a duplicate of himself. Called Judge Twofold, who looks just like him, only he's like 11 feet tall. I didn't mean to say 11 feet tall. It came out 11 feet tall. I'm sticking with it. He's 11 feet tall. But yeah, giant version of himself. I pictured like one of those like In the Heart of the Beast puppets with like the big hand, like just a sort of like big, terrifying vision of himself. Trying himself, finds himself guilty no matter what he does. He can't escape the machinery of justice, which is apropos because in his own court, you could never escape the machinery of justice. Like, it doesn't matter how innocent you are. Once you're before the judge, you are guilty, and nothing is going to stop you from being found guilty and either being sent to hard labor or being put to death or whatever. And now he finds himself within his own system and these mysterious shadow people who are like, there's this whole thing about like, typically in stories like this, you see like when trials are presented or a person is confronted by their own like their own horrificness, they are being tried and judged by representatives of heaven, like godlike creatures, like pure good creatures. In this story, no one's good. Like even the people judging him are not judging him because they are good. They represent the side of justice. There's something else going on, which is why I'm curious. You can't see it. I am circling your face with my cursor. Mm-hmm. I am curious to hear your point when we get to the end here, because I have a sneaking suspicion I know what it is, and it's something that never occurred to me. But then he gets tortured. He actually gets physically tortured. They clamp a leg iron on him that is still hot from the fire, and it melts into his skin. But then he wakes up. Was it all a dream? Who knows? But he has terrible gout after this, and he starts getting ill. The weeks go by. He's been sentenced to death in a month. He starts getting like losing his mind a little bit. He can't sleep. He's gets sicker and sicker and sicker. And then the night of the night when he's supposed to be sent to his execution, Pinewick appears in the house. It is seen by the little girl, the daughter of the housekeeper. Then the housekeeper sees a shadow of a man. She sees a shadowy figure. Then this other maid sees these giant men building more iron shackles. She sees the body of Harbottle on the floor. She panics and screams. And then that night, the next day, Harbottle is found having hung himself, which leads us to the ghost encountered by the old man in the beginning of the story, which was he saw an old man with a noose and another man walking with him, who we discover is actually Pinewick. So there's apparently two ghosts in this mansion, the ghost of the evil man, and then the ghost of the man who condemned him. And that's kind of the story. It's more weird than horror, I think. In fact, I would put Mr. Justice Harbottle firmly in the weird. That's just a basic rough outline of the story. It doesn't take into account the fact that the story is trippy in places and all phantasmagoric. It's a strange tale, and it's eerie, but it's more just unnerving. And his power and corruption fade away like everything else. And the story of the judge exists. The judge exists from this point on only in story, in contradictory narratives, in tales of dual lives, and very, very apropos in a story of fraud and disguise, which is one of the big themes that carries over throughout this story. Fraud. So I ended the story and I was like, that was a good story. I don't know if it's really a ghost story. It's really weird. Who were these people? How did all this happen? And that's as far as I got because I was taking notes. We start recording. Something comes out of you that I hadn't even thought about. And now I'm turning the floor over to my co-host, Willow, who I think is going to blow my mind.
I disagree. I have no idea what you could possibly think I'm going to say. It's stressing me out. What the heck are you talking about?
That this fairies.
Yeah, it's fairies.
So explain.
I don't know how exactly to explain it. I mean, first of all, there's doppelgangers.
Okay, and what does that have to do with the world of fairy?
Changelings.
Oh, is that a thing that they do?
Changelings, yeah. Well, it depends on what legend you read. Doppelgangers and changelings can be the same thing. They can be different things. Essentially, there are doppelgangers that can change their forms, and they generally are in the world of fairy. I have no idea what you are thinking I'm going to say.
Well, because it never occurred to me, we haven't dealt with fairy in so long.
Oh, well, yeah. Also, just the court system.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I see what you mean by, like, the heaven thing. But also, for me, I associate, like, courts with fairy, mostly because of their weird rules.
Yeah, yeah.
And the idea that they aren't going to play fair. Like, you do something against them, they're going to kill you regardless of whether or not. It doesn't matter what you try and do afterwards.
So are you suggesting that Pinewick was actually a member of the fairy court, or like was one of their people, or was maybe under their protection?
Not necessarily. I think people tend to be pawns to them, and I think that they saw this guy, this human man, living the way he did, and were like, you know, let's just knock him down a couple pegs.
He does get up to strange stuff in that house. They're very, again, vague. Le Fanu doesn't let you see what happens behind the closed doors of Harbottle's house. But, I mean, as long as we're going in this direction, it reminds me of at the time, there were people who were amateur magicians and were, mm-hmm. you know, attempting to divine the occult. And one of the ways you did that was by trying to get a fairy on your side.
Yeah.
To give you access to magic. So
also, did you say this guy's Irish?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, that just furthers my point anyways. It does.
No slight against the Irish.
No, I'm just, there's a lot of really interesting folklore about fairies.
No, that is very interesting. Irish folklore is very much connected to the legend of the fae. And mm-hmm. stories of fairies. So we for any listeners who had not listened to us the first year we existed, we tended to go off on the fairy rant quite a bit, especially once we got to like certain movies. What was
Mama?
It? Mama, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, and there was a third one. Oh, The Orphanage.
Yeah.
They all seem to be secret. Well, not,
was that the trilogy?
Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, but yeah, the ones that we always called the trilogy.
Yeah.
Produced by Guillermo del Toro, but not directed by Guillermo del Toro. But he had a strong hand in them, and only.
Or, well, maybe Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, was that still part of it?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Because that was the one that dealt explicitly with.
Right. Fairy. Yeah.
He wrote that one. It wasn't directed by him, but there was like a book and everything that.
Yeah.
That
I have that book.
Yeah, and he. And so we were like, well, Mama seems, the orphanage seems to fit this as well. Like the weirdness of this ghost story actually seems more like someone made a bad deal with the fairies.
Mm-hmm.
And now everything's going, is all screwed up for the humans. And then we were like, wait a minute, same thing with Mama. It doesn't seem like we're dealing with a ghost. It seems like we're dealing with a vengeful fairy spirit. Like something with a little more intelligence, but that's obeying rules that we can't possibly understand. Mm-hmm. And that suddenly to us made those movies a lot more watchable and a lot scarier, kind of.
Yeah.
Like ghosts are one thing, but malevolent, like magical creatures who are ticked off at you is more horrifying.
Mm-hmm. Also just like ghosts still follow human rules.
Right. And they tend to not be. They tend to just want their own like rights wrong, wrongs righted, and that's it. And that's easily understood. Like dig up their bones, bury them in a graveyard, catch the murderer. Mm-hmm. But a fairy's like, I don't know.
Let me turn this child into a bunch of butterflies.
Right. Or we don't like this judge. He's been dabbling in stuff he should have stayed away from. But I wonder, so if let's blue sky it. Say the fairy theory is, I won't say correct because we will never know, but if he had left the trial alone, say he had been like, okay, I won't try Pinewick, would the fairies have left him alone?
Probably. They said they would.
Yeah? Is that how they work?
Yeah. I mean, isn't it like in some places a thing where a fairy can't break a promise?
Oh, I guess that's true.
You make a verbal deal with a fairy and they have to follow through with it.
Yeah. Yeah. That would also explain why they were able to clobber the footman so easily.
Yeah, and also why an old man became a young man.
Old man. And why the old man looked like Pinewick?
Mm-hmm.
Why would they have made themselves look like Pinewick?
Guilt. Not their guilt.
Oh, I see.
Not their guilt. His guilt.
They
like tormenting people.
I was also wondering if maybe they just didn't understand that not all people look like that.
Could be.
But that makes sense then, because then he starts getting tormented with physical people. Mm-hmm. Like he gets, I mean, some stuff can be called a dream, but it's that fairy world type thing where are you dreaming or are you simply in another person's realm?
Mm-hmm.
And he gets injured in that realm and it replicates itself as gout in our world. Like his body justifies the pain. And I guess that would explain then why the little girl was able to see them and the mom.
Mm-hmm.
And then the weird appearance of the giant forgers forging the chains in the basement. Because they are giant. They're not they're not just ghosts. I like this better. Like, I don't know if it's true. I don't know if J. Sheridan Le Fanu ever wrote stories about fairy. I don't know. He wrote so many stories. But I like that idea. I like the notion that even if it doesn't completely fit, that he did something, you know, if we're going to try to justify it, it's as a from plot perspective, that he did something to tick off the Fae, and that's what happened, man. Who were the ghosts then?
I think they were changelings.
No. I mean, now that house is still haunted.
Yeah,
so
it could be genuine ghosts at that point.
At that point. Yes, because he...
Yeah, because I, like... It could just be him trapped in the realm of the Fae,
like
being
forced
tormented.
Relive his
That seems like something they'd do.
Yeah. It is interesting, though, that he commits suicide. Like, they do an investigation, and they're like, this guy wasn't murdered. There's no sign of a struggle. He just killed himself in the house. Mm-hmm. And the idea is supposed to be like, was he made forced to do this? Did he just succumb to like the torment that he was undergoing? But now knowing that there's another intelligence working behind this, I don't know, maybe he thought this was a way to get out of the horrible deal he had made and it didn't work.
There's no getting out of a deal with fairies.
There is no getting out of a deal with a fairy.
Unless you, there's like several hundred ways you can get out of a deal with fairies, but all of them are too weird and nuanced for any normal person to think of.
Certainly not for someone with a carbuncled nose.
I think that's not true.
yeah, so there's a lot of, beyond the fairy, there's a lot of subtle themes in this that just completely pass us by because we don't live in Ireland in the 1800s. But there's very, like, just reading about it, there's very specific references to the ins and outs of the justice system, to the ins and outs of the landlord system that color this story a lot. And I actually read an entire master's thesis on this in preparation. That was amazing. That's how dedicated I am to this show.
You have more dedication to this show than I do.
You were in college. You're allowed an hour. I only have work and another kid.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I thought of fairies, though. I'd you dedicated did. To this show in a very different way.
You did. I was so pleased. I was just like, wow, you have a working theory. You came in with a theory and it worked.
Yeah. Hey, man, I come in with theories a lot of the time. I just never say them.
You just never say them. Oh, by the way, this is The Dark Descent, David G. Hartwell.
Blah, 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 blah,
blah. Blah, blah, blah. This is from the section of The Dark Descent, let us not forget, called The Color of Evil. And I think this story of many of them, I mean, a lot of them have now started fitting into that, but this one's really just like The Color of Evil. Like, this dude was evil. Really quick, David G. Hartwell says that Le Fanu and Poe are, according to Jack Sullivan, the first short story writers in England to work out carefully planned aesthetic strategies of horror. They were also among the first to write modern horror stories. Their habitual strict attention to the unity of mood and economy of means is a quality we take for granted in short fiction today, but it was virtually unknown to their more didactically inclined contemporaries. He says that Le Fanu is more revolutionary than Poe, for he began the process of dismantling the gothic props and placing the supernatural tale in everyday settings.
You want to know why Poe is more well known?
Why?
Because his name is Poe.
Poe.
And it's easier to remember than Le Fanu.
Le Fanu. But we discussed Le Fanu briefly years ago when we discussed... We did when we discussed the movie Vampire, because Vampire is loosely based on Carmilla. And I mean, loosely, but we did bring him up. Again, Carmilla also helped create and solidify the vampire's place in English literature. So,
is Carmilla the lesbian vampire story, or is that a different one?
Lesbian. Yes, that's a yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes. It also firmly established the trope of lesbian vampires. So, yeah.
We should bring that trope back.
Go for it.
Okay.
Do it. I
forgot I'm a writer for a second.
I don't think I'm qualified, and
I don't think he was qualified either.
That's true. It's true. But that's Mr. Justice Harbottle. If you're looking to read it and you don't own The Dark Descent, it is freely available online, wherever websites are sold. Yeah, and I dug it. I thought it was very long, but it was also effective, and it gave us a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
So any idea what our next short story is?
My book is about 5 feet away from me.
Do you want to get it?
I would, but that takes effort.
Okay. Our next short story, readers at home, followers along, is...
Readers
at home, like people who want to read along with us. Our next story is... Drum roll. The Crowd by Ray Bradbury.
Oh, my worst nightmare.
I hope we all know who Ray Bradbury is.
Yes.
And a legitimate short story. It's like a 10-minute read. And...
Nice.
Only two characters. And
also nice.
It's told in chronological order.
How is it a crowd if there's only two characters?
It's about a crowd, but there's only two characters. You'll find it.
I
read it today in between things. I was like, what's this one about? Then I was like, oh, I'm done. Well, that was fast.
Answered the question either.
What?
What it's about. You just read it. You asked the question. Never got an answer.
I never got an answer. I totally forgot. I forgot to follow along. I forgot to remember what happened on previous pages as I turned each page. Unfortunately,
I do that sometimes.
It's the worst way. Oh my god! I always at night we go to bed so late. It's so stupid. Late for an old man like me.
No, I wasn't laughing at that. I was just laughing at the fact that you go to bed late and have the audacity to.
I go to bed so late. I'm usually not crawling into bed until 11:45, which is late for me.
Yeah, it is late.
And then I have to read because I'm used to it now and I can't just go straight to bed. So I pull out my book to read and I'm not following anything. Every night is just me trying to catch up with what I read the night before, which was what I read the night before that. Like, it's just the same like two pages over and over again of whatever spooky story I'm trying to read. But I don't know what point I was trying to make. Why did I bring that up?
Because I said, that's how I read. I don't know. What were we talking about?
The Crowd by Ray Bradbury. So join us next week, won't you? For The Crowd by Ray Bradbury. We will try to get the next episode out on time. And yes, we are in the Halloween month. So it's good that we are... Oh my God, I'm knocking everything over. It's a good thing that we are now firmly in Spook Central because it's Halloween. And unfortunately, there's no ghosts in our next story. But there's a
ghost behind you.
Oh noes. We could have made this a short episode, but instead we talked about crap for the last 10 minutes. Yeah, so join us next week for The Crowd by Ray Bradbury. And until then, I'm Phil.
And I'm Willow.
And we'll see you when
it's Del Toro time. Bye.
Goodbye.
Spooks and ghosts and ghosts and goblins, ghosts and goblins, Halloween. I didn't press stop.